call the meeting to order. I think that really should happen with you, Chairman Dahmer, and Joanna can start the establishing the quorum with roll call.
I would love to call the meeting to order and have roll call begin.
You're muted, Joanna.
Okay, sorry.
2023 problems.
Ted Moeller?
Present.
Keith Dahmer?
Here.
Nicole Lowry?
Hello, here.
I think that is it for the quorum.
So you would call the other members who are not here and then record them as absent.
Mike Hanley. Joyce Garland.
She's going to be excused. She's at a required meeting.
Okay, so I do think a quorum has been established with the three board members.
Thank you.
So then we can move on to the second item on the agenda, introductions.
So, Chairman Dahmer, before we do that, I'd like to remind everyone that because this is a virtual meeting, especially for our trustees, that they will need to remain on camera. And if indeed, because we only have three, if they step away from this meeting, we no longer have a quorum. And because of that, we would have to stop anything with any action, and the meeting would actually just be informational. So just remember that. And then if they want to speak, obviously the controls are up at the very top. Well, it just depends on what type of unit that you're using, but your controls, remember to raise your hand and not all speak at once, but give everyone an opportunity to speak. And Julie will go over some of that when we start talking about voting protocol. But I wanted just to remind you, it's really critical because we only have three of our trustees here. That is our quorum. So if anyone steps away and is off camera, we will have an issue.
Thank you,
Chairman Dahmer. Okay. Introductions it is.
So how are we going to, do you want all the trustees to introduce and then the rest of you, or is that how, I'm Keith Dahmer, I'm the chairperson of the Self-Insurance Trust Board. Hi.
So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to help you out a little bit because I can see the people in the chat. Joanna, you would be next. She's muted.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so Joanna, previously management assistant, new claims adjuster.
That's one of the changes, and it looks like we have someone that just joined us. I'm going to go ahead and Nicole, you're next.
Hi, I'm Nicole Lowry, risk manager for Tucson Unified and trustee.
Ted Moeller.
Hi, I'm Ted Moeller. I'm an Arizona workers' compensation attorney.
And
trustee.
Thank you, Ted. Julie Hughes.
Julie Hughes, I'm the chief deputy city attorney for the city of Tucson.
Noemi.
Hi, I'm Noemi Mills, lead HR analyst for Occupational Health and Leave.
Sarah.
Sarah Hussick, Human Resources Manager for the Occupational Health and Leaves Division.
Trevor.
Trevor Steck with the Mahoney Group, and I'm the insurance consultant and advisor for the city.
Mary. Mary, you're on mute.
Are you done?
Mayor, you're still on mute, I think.
I may have to introduce her.
I can introduce her. Mary Wells is part of my team at the Mahoney Group, and she's one of our work comp specialists, VP of our senior risk management.
And she indicates she is having problems, so she will definitely be in listen mode. And then, of course, I'm Allie Matthews, the risk management administrator. And I think that's it for the introductions for those that have joined us as special guests or staff. Yes.
Allie, I've just joined.
Allie, it's Mike Hanley. I just got on. Sorry. Mike Hanley, founder and president of Bank of Tucson.
And trustee.
And trustee.
And absolutely. Then Vince. That's correct. And Vince, you're on the line. Thank you for joining, Vince. Vince, will you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Vince Tracy. I'm the Safety and Health Loss Control Manager for the City of Tucson. Hello, everybody. Hey, Keith.
Chairman Dummer, I think that's everyone, and I think that ends our introductions, and we can move on to the next item on the agenda.
That would be item three, that we might motion and voting decorum from Julie Hughes.
Sure. Hi, I'm happy to provide some basic instructions so that we follow rules of the proper Roberts Rules of Order when people want to make a motion and then have action taken, voted on, etc. So it's traditionally the chair does not make the motion. It's usually the members that make a motion. So Mr. Chairman, you would be the one to recognize an individual who wants to make a motion. They would, in a virtual, raise their hand indicating they want to make the motion. You recognize them. They state that they make a clearly worded motion to take action or position, and they start that by saying, "I move." And then their motion has to be seconded. So you don't have, the second comes in, and then you, Chairman, restate the motion and the fact that it has a second, and then you proceed to discussion and debate. And I believe what's been happening is that motions are probably being made, or people are discussing actions that the board wants to take. And then I'm not sure if you're getting a second, but I believe your debate is occurring either before the second or before the motion, but the motion has to be made. You have to get a second. Then you put it out for discussion, also called debate. You then determine whether anybody, and you go in order so that each person who wants to add something to discussion has an opportunity. Each person would be recognized by the chair and address the chair as Mr. Chair, and then whatever their commentary is. And then you would make the determination as to whether further discussion is needed, or ask if anybody has anything else. And then you call it for a vote, but you restate the motion again so that people know what they're voting on. And then you call the vote, and it can be either, you know, by roll call, or it can be ayes and nays. And then you call the tally. So there's basically six parts to every motion. There's the actual motion, which requires the member to raise their hand or stand and be recognized by the chair. Another member then seconds, and that is not the chair. The chair is not making the motion. It's going to be another member. Anybody can second. The chair then restates the actual motion, then debate or discussion on the motion, then a vote. So the chair restates the motion before the vote, and then asks for affirmative and then negative votes, or does a roll call, and then announces the vote. And if the board is in agreement or appears to be in agreement, you don't necessarily have to have any debate. You can say if there being no objection, you can just call the vote then or adopt the motion. Or if you get an objection at that point, then you have discussion, or you can say hearing no objection, then you call the vote. So, I mean, it's pretty basic. You just really have to make sure that you are doing this each time that you are bringing a point forward, and identifying by saying I move and just using formalized, it's semi-formalized, you'll get in the habit of doing it. Recognition, the second, the restating, so you know what you're discussing. Now, if you get to the point where the motion has been made and seconded, and then you have discussion, you may have somebody say that they move to amend, if, after you recognize them, that a move to amend the motion requires a second. And I will send you a cheat sheet. I will give one to Allie so she can distribute. And I have a really nice one that literally, I'm holding it up here. You may or may not be able to see it, but it just goes down a list, and it's so basic. And that way you can actually look at it and follow along when you're in your meetings. But this way you maintain decorum. These things are not personal. It's really just discussing the facts and the issues, and you make sure that your action is duly recorded, that you've made the appropriate motion, someone's made it, there's been a second, there's been full and fair discussion, and then the motion is, a vote is taken, and it's either passed or not passed. So, I mean, it really is that basic. I just want to make sure that you all understand that it really needs to be done throughout and at each one of your meetings. The chair runs it, and so the chair does not make the motions, but the chair recognizes the individual wanting to make the motion. And when I send you the cheat sheet, it'll give you, there's like a little graph that shows different things that don't require a second, like point of order or personal, I forget what it's called. Those are usually done when the room's too hot or too cold or it's too noisy. I don't think you have that issue right now, but it does keep things moving in an orderly fashion. There's motions that can be made if the discussion seems to be taking too long. An individual can raise point of order again to get things moving, or you can also request that time limits be put in place, so that each person who is going to discuss or debate knows what the limit is. Like, you're going to limit, if you have a lot of people that want to talk, you could limit it to 2 to 5 minutes. I don't think that's usually a problem with this group. It's not like you have 30 people that want to talk, so you don't have to restrict it. But you'll find that you have an orderly flow, people know what they're discussing and debating, and when they go to the vote, they know what they're voting on. So it is that basic. And there's even a book. It's great. It's Robert's Rules for Dummies. So, and that's more information than you need, but I will get you the cheat sheet so that you can just look at it at the beginning of each one of your meetings to make sure that you're in compliance.
It feels like we've been doing all or most of this on a regular basis, just kind of casually. It feels like we've had a history of maybe where the department was sort of assisting running the meeting and the chair was, I don't want to call myself a figurehead, but more figureheady. and so it seems like we're formalizing this up and changing the roles around a little bit from our history. I believe we are in compliance in everything we've done in the past. We just want to make it more clear and slightly more formal going forward. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think you are in compliance. I know the ones that I've attended, I've not seen anything. And if I would, I know that I would jump in and say, well, time out, you have to do this. But yeah, I think as the chair, it's really incumbent upon you to actually run the meetings. And I think that will help with making sure that you're following each one of these steps. But yes, your summation was exactly what's been going on.
And then I have two questions.
Yes.
First one is relating to the motion and the vote. I'm accustomed to, from some other boards, where the actual vote and the recording of the vote is done by the department staff who is tracking that and did the roll call, for example. I want to make sure I'm hearing from you that I am now the one that's sort of doing the roll call vote myself rather than turning it over to someone to go through the trustees and ask for their vote. Is that correct?
Well, I'm trying to think of in terms of, does it have to be done that way? Because I don't think it does. I know when you do a roll call vote, I think it would probably be better to have whomever's serving in the secretarial role. That way they would go through probably starting with you or ending with you. But I think that way it keeps the record clean. I'm just going to use mayor and council as an example. The city clerk does the roll call when they're doing a roll call vote. When it's just when they're asking all those in favor and you could do it by show of hands, I believe you could do that. Sure. But I think if you want to do a roll call, I just think it would be probably cleaner to have whomever's performing secretarial. I don't think there's a prohibition on you doing it. I've not seen that. I just think it might work better that way. But if you don't need to take it via roll call, I think you could just call for the vote and ask for ayes and nays.
Thank you. And remind me, Ali, our trust board does not have an official secretary position. Your staff is fulfilling that role for us in general. Is that correct?
That is correct. You have whoever is supporting the risk management administrator providing that support role. So typically what has happened, Keith, in the past is the chairman has either said all those in favor say aye, those opposed nay, and that's been recorded. When we've gone to the virtual format, it's been an audible yes or nay, but it might be wise because with the recordings being on for them to raise their hands so that it's visual and it can be seen.
Okay. Yeah. Second question then has to do with the motion first. So what I'm what I'm hearing is that there's no chance for an informative discussion or presentation, that everything the trustees talk about is actually a debate. We can't. So I'm thinking of the one main thing that we do every year is approve the rates to fund the trust fund. There is a significant amount of presentation and discussion where trustees are asking their questions and trying to get an idea of how the rates were formatted. And we do all of that before anyone moves anything. So my question is, do we have to start that every year with a move to approve the rates before we even know what the rates are all about? I'm having a little trouble with that. It has to start with a motion.
No. I think the presentation would probably take place the way you've normally done it. But before you take any action based on the presentation, like if you're voting on or if you're taking action on something, then there has to be a motion made. And then there would be a second and then discussion regarding what the presentation was. Although it technically it could too. You could move. Somebody could move. They would be recognized that you have the presentation and on it, and that's just having the presentation. So there's really nothing to debate at that time. I don't know that you have to move to hear the presentation because it would have been agendized as a presentation from a member or from an entity who's coming in to give you an informative or an instructional. And then following that, there will be a motion to either adopt or pursue something else. And that would require a second. And then a vote. So I guess it kind of, I hate to say it depends. That's such a lawyer response to something, but it depends on what the situation is. And I know that a lot of times you just have informational items put on your agenda, but Ali can provide more. I see she has her hand up and she can provide more on that.
Ali?
So typically what happens, Keith, from every presentation that occurs where there is an action item, particularly along the lines of the rate approval, there's going to be discussion first. The item that's agendized then comes with a recommendation for approval. So what's usually on the agenda is the presentation. Then after the presentation, the next item on the agenda is the recommendation. And that item that's agendized under the recommendation is considered an action item. That is going to be your clue that that's going to require a motion.
So
yeah,
that's when you are going to want to entertain that motion from the floor. So whenever you yeah. look at the agenda and you see an info slash action item, you know a motion is going to be forthcoming. If it just says action, immediately you're going to want a motion.
Okay.
Yeah, and as the chair, you're going to ask for a motion, and then you will recognize whomever it is that raises their hand. They will make the motion, and then you'll ask, is there a second? And when there's a second, you restate the motion that has been made, and then you can discuss the information that was just presented to you prior to taking your vote. But you need your second before you begin. And I call it debate. It's discussion or debate. Either one, it's the same thing. But that's how you initiate that process.
So I think, you know, I'm vaguely remembering that we got a presentation about the rates in November. And then maybe we had some kind of discussion about what we might want to do with those rates. And that might have been where we crossed the line. We should have had the motion and then have discussion and debate somewhere. I think we moved from the presentation to what are we going to do without having a motion first. So maybe if I'm understanding that we could have done that a little bit better last time. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes. No?
I don't know that would necessarily be true, because you're still trying to formulate an idea of what you want to do and put it in a form of a motion. And that's where your direction comes from the attorney that's assisting us with what we're doing. I think you can, it kind of can flow along the part of the discussion. I don't know that you have to have a motion so that you can have the discussion.
Okay.
And well, the motion will be
the attorney can help us with that.
Yeah, and it is. That's why I said it kind of depends, because it will depend on where you are and what you want to do next. And if you just want to continue talking about it based on and have like questions for the presenter, none of that's going to, at that point, that doesn't require that there be a motion. If there's action that's going to be taken, you want to get that out there, you want to get a second, and then you want to have your conversation, because you're going to be voting. And if it's something that you're going to be voting on, you need to have the motion, the second, and then the conversation regarding the nature of the motion, and then the vote.
Great.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry if this was confusing. It's not confusing, but it is. When you hear it in the abstract, when you're doing it, it actually makes sense.
Great. Thank you very much. I will. So, and we'll always have someone watching while I'm doing this. That and Juliana, if that's you, please feel free to stop me anytime I'm doing something wrong and prevent me from misbehaving. I would appreciate that. And anyone else here?
Thank you. I will make sure I raise my hand, and it'll usually be Michelle Saavedra, but we will do that. That's one of our roles, is to make sure that you're compliant, but I'll raise my hand or start clapping or something to get attention, if as long as they're virtual, and just kind of gently say, you know, prior to doing that, Mr. Chair, somebody needs to move that you take whatever action it is.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, is there any other information coming to us on item 3 about motion voting decorum? All right, then I see Allie's hand is still up.
So just so that you know, your next item is an action item.
Thank you. Item number 4, approval of minutes. I read the minutes before the meeting and didn't see anything needed changing. This should be just a general action item. I would love to entertain a motion to approve the minutes for our November 29th, 2022 meeting.
This is Ted Moeller. Can I move to approve the minutes of the November 29, 22 meeting?
Ted Moeller just approved the... moved to approve the meetings of the November 29, 2022 meeting. I would love to entertain a second on Ted's motion.
This is Nicole Lowry, second.
Hi, Nicole. I'll take Nicole's second on Ted's motion to approve the November 29, 2022 meeting as presented in the draft version of our document. I will entertain anybody's discussion on this if there is none. And I'm not seeing anyone throwing their hands up or flailing about wanting to talk in detail about the minutes. I think we can just do this kind of quickly. I can't see everybody on my screen with this presentation, so hand raising doesn't actually work for me, because right now I see Vince and Allie and Juliana and Ted. I don't know how to change my screen, so will I see, if everyone just starts waving, will I see them? Right.
No, so.
Can I just, I don't know how the wave's going to work then. I could say all in favor say aye, and if there's none opposed, then I can just call it as a unanimous vote. Is that correct without the visual?
Yes.
Right. Aye.
All right. I would love, is everyone, all trustees who are in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed to the motion to approve the November 29th meeting from 2022 as presented in draft form in our meeting packet? I'm not seeing or hearing any trustees opposed to that, so I am calling the tally as unanimous to approve the Ted's motion to approve the November 29, 2022 minutes. And with that being done, I think we can move on to our unfinished business section. I think we've got an information section that Ted's going to give us at some point. We'll also talk about a revision to the code that's going to be information and then an action. So I will try and time my leap in to get a motion appropriately, but I'm going to turn this over now to Ted.
So, Chairman Dahmer, before you do that, I want
I've done it wrong already.
No. I want to prime the trustees for Ted's presentation and the reason for that. You did good. You did awesome. I have actually started sharing my screen. And the reason that I did that is because there is a purpose behind asking Ted to provide the presentation. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
So on the screen, you guys should be seeing a slide that talks about workers' compensation open claims overview as of March 15th, 2023. Do you see that slide?
Yes.
Yes.
So the city of Tucson is self-insured, and the trustees know that, for workers' compensation claims. And what that means is that we handle all of our claims from inception until closure. And with workers' compensation claims, that is perpetuity, essentially. It's until death. And right now, there are a number of claims that have significant reserves on them. And so what I've asked Sarah to do, which she provided me on March 15th, was a list of all of our claims. And we have over 7,000 claims that are open. But of those 7,000 claims, we have 103 of them with cases that have, and I only looked at cases with that are open, that have over $250,000 of incurred expenses. That includes reserves. And of those, we have significant reserves over $100,000. $100,000 is quite a bit. And then we have five cases of open WC claims that are over $1 million that have reserves of over $500,000. And of that, I excluded any of those claims that have dependents, because when they have dependents, these are not cases that we're going to want to talk about with full and final settlements or structured settlements, because it involves children, and those become very touchy cases. And then as we were going through the annual stewardship report with the current third-party administrator, one of the things that they pointed out is the percentage of the city's indemnity claims, we were seeing an increase, a significant increase. And of that, 2% of the city's claims exceed the $100,000 threshold for incurred costs. So we're seeing an uptick. And being a self-insured entity, that has a significant impact on the fund itself.
And I know as we have presented to the trustees in the past, we have seen that fund deplete itself. And in order for us to continue to be a healthy fund, we don't want to dip into our investments. We have to pay attention to the reserves. So we need to start looking at the options and the opportunities that we have with structured and or full and final settlements. And that's where actually Ted comes in to kind of help us with that. So I kind of wanted to have this opportunity for Ted to be the expert that he is across the state and provide us with his expertise and help us understand what full and final settlement and or structured settlements look like. So, Ted, are you ready to share your screen?
I don't have anything to share on my screen. I just have a verbal presentation, if that's okay.
That works. That works for us. So let's go with it.
Well, and hopefully it'll be brief enough and informative enough for you. I'd invite anybody to at any time raise a question, and I'm happy to discuss things as we go. One of the things that I wasn't planning on mentioning, but that based on what Allie said, I think is worth mentioning, is I think that one of the big reasons that the cost of these claims is going up, particularly with regard to indemnity, is because of the average monthly wage laws with workers' compensation. The way that these claims are administered is that the indemnity benefits are based on mathematical calculations arising from the worker's average monthly wage, and there is a ceiling on that wage. About 25, 26 years ago when I began practicing, I believe the average monthly wage was $1,600, and I remember that was typically the one that we would deal with. It's gone up from there to $2,100 to $2,400, and it's shot up more recently to, I don't know the exact number now, but I believe it's about $6,000 a month. And there is every anticipation that it will raise significantly in the future every year. And so that is probably one of the main reasons that we have an increase in the indemnity. And it's something I think that we can and need to anticipate will continue to happen. Now, the full and final settlements solution that now exists in Arizona workers' compensation has been around since 2018. It is probably more easily understood by non-workers' compensation people than it is by workers' compensation people, because it is a landscape type change for us that we haven't seen before. A full and final settlement in workers' compensation is more similar to what you would see in a personal injury claim normally, where, for example, if I were on my way home, stopped at the grocery store and slipped on a grape and fell and broke my hip, I might decide to sue that grocery store for negligence, and the parties, both sides, would analyze the value of the thing, and they would come up with a settlement number that both could agree on, and that would be paid, and that would be the end of that lawsuit and the end of any right of action that I might have, and the any rights that I would have to pursue additional action against the grocery store would be forever foreclosed. Arizona workers' compensation, as it was originally designed, would not allow that. It is a paternalistic system intended to care and to continue caring for injured workers from the point of their injury until they die. And as a result, the way these things are normally administered and adjudicated is in kind of a piecemeal manner. They're set up so that at each step of the injury and recovery and impairment process, different determinations are made, and then those determinations can be challenged by a request for hearing or a protest, often by either party. And the way it is set up is so that this can go on for the balance of a worker's life. So rather than trying or determining or settling all aspects of the case at once, we do them little by little. We would first begin with determining whether or not a claim is a compensable claim, meaning a valid claim in the Arizona workers' compensation system. Once that is determined and that claim is accepted as compensable, in the past, we were forever foreclosed from settling the agreement in a way that would completely end that claim so that the worker could never come back and make any additional claims. With the compensability determination, that ended. Once a claim is compensable, then we deal with, as the issues arise, whether treatment is necessary, and there are various categories of medical treatment or classifications of medical treatment within the workers' compensation system, each of which can be adjudicated as we go. And the same is true with indemnity. There are various forms of indemnity, each of which is adjudicated as we go. And then, as if that's not enough, once a claim is finally closed and a permanent impairment rating is determined, and the medical treatment is terminated and everything seems to be done, the worker has the right for the balance of their life to file a petition to reopen to seek additional medical treatment. And that kind of begins everything all over again with the disability process, with the medical process, with the determination of permanent impairment, and so on. And as a result, I currently am dealing with workers' compensation claims where the injury occurred well prior to when I began law school. It's because they can just go on forever and there's no way to permanently end them. Now, at first in the workers' compensation system, probably because it's designed to be paternalistic, there were no settlements that were allowed at all. Eventually they allowed settlement of compensability only. And then over time that has been chipped away at to where other small aspects of the claims can be settled bit by bit as you go. And it's not uncommon to have multiple settlements over multiple years on various small parts of a workers' compensation claim, but none of those settlements was ever able to fully close a claim so that it was permanently and totally closed and nothing else could come of it in the future. In 2018, there were statutes that were passed in Arizona for a full and final settlements. And with that, we have the first time that we're able to settle a claim in its entirety where there is no future possible course of action. The only time we were able to do that before was if we settled a claim as non-compensable, because there would have been an agreement, this is not a compensable or a valid workers' compensation claim, and that would foreclose everything. But once that hurdle was crossed, which happens very quickly in the workers' compensation process, you would have never been able to settle out everything again. Now, after compensability has been accepted, you can do so. And there's quite a few requirements that need to be met and rules for the process, but it is still a valid and reasonable process and one that results in quite a few settlements. And so it's a good option to consider in these matters. Typically, the way these full and final settlements work is they are divided into the two obvious portions, which are the indemnity portion and the medical portion. And generally speaking, the parties negotiate them that way as well. And so what most likely happens is that if both parties are serious about settling a workers' compensation claim as a full and final settlement, they will first enter into a negotiation regarding indemnity and see if they can come up with a number that both parties can agree on that would be a sufficient payment to forever foreclose the injured worker from ever seeking additional indemnity under any circumstances in their workers' compensation claim. If that number can be reached, then the parties would move forward and try to figure out if they could reach a settlement on the medical as well. And it's a very different process than the indemnity, because the settlement process for a full and final settlement in Arizona workers' compensation is intended to cover all future medical treatment with the understanding and the determination that all past workers' compensation related medical treatment has been paid, all medical liens have been covered, and there are no outstanding bills to the injured worker, and that the money being paid under medical is intended to pay for everything that is going to happen or reasonably be expected to happen for future medical treatment. Typically, the way that determination is made is by retaining one of these companies that can calculate for you what the future medical costs will be for the balance of the worker's life based on their age and the specific injuries that they have, the past treatment that they've had, and so on. What happens is they will come up with a specific number and say, this is what we believe the future medical will cost for this for the balance of the worker's life. Now, at that point is where Medicare, or the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, comes into play. They make significant efforts to be sure that their rights are protected in these matters. They don't want us to settle something and then have the cost of future treatment for this medical industrial issue to be passed on to Medicare. And as a result, it is wise to try to get Medicare to approve the amount of money for the Medi-Cal portion of the settlement. They have certain thresholds that have to be met just because of a workflow issue for them. If the settlement is a large enough settlement under the circumstances, then they will consider and approve the settlement or revise and they don't approve the settlement. They approve the estimate for the future medical costs, and they will either approve that or they will revise it to meet what they believe is an appropriate amount to be set aside for this worker's treatment for the rest of their life. And when they do this, they do it in a way that really lends itself to structured settlements, because they'll give you two options typically in the letter that approves it. The first option, they'll say, here's the lump sum amount of money that will cover them, and if you want to pay that amount of money now, that will do it. And then they also say, if you don't want to pay that lump sum and you want to do it as more like an annuity, then you have to pay the initial seed money, and that is held in a special account for payment of medical bills only. And then after that seed money is paid, then each year for a set amount of years that they determine, they tell you what additional specific amount of money will need to be paid into that same medical account so that all medical treatment is covered that should be covered under the Arizona Workers' Compensation. And the goal with that is that all of the medical will be covered with that amount of money. And if the treatment for some reason exceeds that amount, then the parties have showed that they have made reasonable efforts to protect the interests of Medicare, and Medicare legally is supposed to step in at that point and pay anything else that has been unpaid given the agreement as made, and to the extent that it was approved by Medicare or Medicaid. As a result, typically the ideal full and final settlement will involve the indemnity determination and then the determination of future medical benefits and an agreement between the parties as to the amount that will be paid for those future medical benefits, which is often made into a structured settlement, as I've explained. And so that's basically how these things work. And the ultimate results of these, which did not really exist until 2018 in Arizona, is to have a full and final settlement, which when entered to, is intended to and has thus far effectively precluded any attempts to revisit the workers' compensation claim for additional benefits by the injured worker. So that's basically the process. If there are any questions or anything else that you feel that I'm missing, please let me know. I'm happy to discuss it.
So, Ted, one of the questions that we continue to hear is, are there any other self-insured entities or anyone doing full and final settlements? I know that I reached out to Nicole to find out if Tucson Unified School District, who belongs to a pool, does full and final settlements. And I believe Nicole's response was, yes, they do. So I'm wondering, are we just late to the show, or are there a lot of other entities that are doing full and final settlements?
There's a gradual buildup. There was one lawyer that's known in the workers' compensation community who said he was going to have over 100 full and final settlements the day they were allowed, and he had zero at that point. But since then, for all of us, we have gradually been doing more and more of these full and final settlements. It takes a while for employers and insurance carriers to get used to them. And it takes a while for the attorneys to get used to and be sure that we are doing them in a way that is going to work. As you might imagine, initially with these things, when we were entering into them, I had conversations with a number of attorneys, both from the defense side and the applicant side, and we discussed aspects of these claims that scared us to death because we couldn't figure out how the statute was supposed to apply and how it might open up our clients and us personally to liability. But over the years, as you might imagine, these things have been smoothed out and sorted out quite a bit to the point where I think that they are becoming more common, and everybody that deals in this system is becoming more comfortable with the process.
Let me ask another question from an insurance perspective. And this is not just on the full and final settlement, but it's a comparison between a full and final settlement versus a structured settlement. Is there a preference on structured versus full and final?
A preference on behalf of the insurance company?
On behalf of someone that's doing it from a perspective of a better outcome for the client, meaning the employee, versus for us, the city.
Okay. If there's typically the structured settlements are used from the medical for the medical portion of the settlement only, and there they are very common. And there does not seem to be any downside that I have heard from the side of the worker. And certainly the option of having a structured settlement is often attractive to the insurance carrier and to the employer. Where I don't see many structured settlements is with the portion of the indemnity. So in other words, often with a full and final settlement, what we see is a lump sum that is paid for the indemnity, and that's it. And then a structured settlement for the medical aspect, where there's the seed money and then yearly payments thereafter, usually with an annuity of some sort purchased for that. The few times that I have approached a worker's attorney about getting a structured settlement for the indemnity portion, they have been quickly dismissed. In fact, the last one that I approached, he said, "I wasn't born yesterday, and I can't believe you even asked me." And so typically with the indemnity, they want their money right away. But with the medical, because it is so supposed to be so strictly accounted for, they're fine with doing the structured settlements.
Allie, if you don't mind, this is Trevor from the Mahoney Group. That was one of my two questions I had, Allie, so good one there. But Ted, I was also wondering if you're seeing this across specific types of claims or sizes of claims, or is it all across the board? I just didn't know if you see a trend in the types of claims that are being structured and done this way.
Well, that's a good question. I haven't seen any specific trends. You know, the most recent full and final settlement I did was for $5,000 only. And so there really wasn't much to it. There was no structure to it or anything else. That was, here's $4,000 for medical, here's $1,000 for indemnity, and that was the end of it. We see a few of those, but I seem to see more where the settlement range is a little higher, often approaching or exceeding $100,000, when you're looking at both the indemnity and the medical, and sometimes going significantly higher than that. And those are the ones where you're normally going to get involved with the CMS approval and getting a determination made as to future, a formal determination made as to what the anticipated future medical costs would be and so on. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I believe so. And then I think that leads into should the city essentially look at certain sizes of claims, types of claims, instead of all across the board at structured and final? What's the best way for us to approach this way of doing it?
That's a good question. And I don't know that I have a good answer. I think that with the smaller claims, when you do it normally with the potential that you're going to have future issues, and you want to be sure that you can get rid of the thing in its entirety. And the future issues can come from the nature of the worker themselves, and obviously go to the type of medical condition that they have and so on. And particularly when you're dealing with somebody who's younger, a lot of times you want to do that and offer a full and final settlement rather than anticipating decades of future administration of the claim. The other side of it with a full and final settlement, I think, is when you have very significantly larger claims, and you anticipate that there could be ongoing and increasing treatment requirements for the years that come. And in those situations, if you are able to arrive at an agreement on an indemnity settlement for the loss of earnings, then I think that it is a good idea to at least look and see what future medical might cost. A lot of times I find that insurers will say, before we even touch on the indemnity portion of this, let's at least get a good idea of what the medical will cost and see if it's something that we feel like we can and want to do. And so they'll at least get a fair idea of what that is, and then approach the other side about the indemnity. But most of the time, if the sides are discussing it, you begin with the indemnity. But usually with the larger claims like that, the decision can be made. This is something that could be sitting around for a while, and 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we may be administering it. And so why don't we at least look at this and see if it's something that we might be able to get off our books entirely forever.
And I think my last question then that I can think of is PTSD. Have you seen a PTSD claim settled?
For a full and final settlement, I don't recall.
Just because that's becoming a bigger issue. You know,
I think the two trends that I see in workers' compensation claims right now are mild traumatic brain injuries and PTSD. Injuries and PTSD, there's been some movement in the law lately that seems to invite more of those as well. I have not seen one for PTSD. I don't see a reason why one couldn't be pursued, but the fact still remains that it is a paternalistic system, and most of the attorneys that represent injured workers value the nature of the system being paternalistic, and they are very hesitant to recommend to certain types of clients that they settle. And I think PTSD clients might be one where they go to the client at times, at least, and say this might not be a good idea for you. But in reality, there's no specific other reason that I can see for not pursuing a PTSD claim. I think it's possible. It's just a matter of, can the parties agree on it?
Well, and I'd say, I don't know if you want to be the first city first city to try and do one. I think you don't want to be the guinea pig, maybe. You got to be careful because that is such a touchy subject at the same time.
Yeah, well, it is a touchy subject, but the process would still be the same, and I think it's still possible to do it. The issues, is as I think you're probably alluding to, would be what type of treatment might be necessary in the future. And sometimes with these PTSD patients, the whole process of trying to settle these things can be emotionally upsetting, and that can create an extra impediment or hurdle.
So with that said, I'm wondering, with my next question, Ted, I know that you'd indicated claims that are 10 years or greater. And when I look at the history of some of our legacy claims that the city has with significant reserves on them, they're over 10 years. So I guess my question is, I don't know where we would start, but we do know that we do need to start, which is why we are coming to the trustees with language that would allow us to begin that process. And knowing that our threshold, based upon the declaration that we just
repealed and replaced in 2021 provides a much smaller authority level. We have to increase that. But what my question would be, knowing that we have such significant reserves out there with legacy claims that are well over 10 years, the types of claims that we would concentrate on are vast. And so I guess what I would be looking for is what do you normally see out there are claims that you usually see that are going to the Industrial Commission and are being approved for full and final settlement so that we would have somewhat of a comparison starting base.
Right. I don't think that there's any specific one type that seems to be dominating the settlement process. What I would say is that a lot of companies are doing the exact same type of analysis that you're discussing, where they're looking at the claims that are the larger claims with the larger reserves that seem to keep coming back or that seem to keep continuing on, and they look at those and try to put a cap on those. And what as I think you and I have both done was we have talked to others to see if there are specific criteria that employers and insurers are using to evaluate these cases. And unfortunately, the response that I have consistently received is that they do it only on a case-by-case basis, and they don't give any other information than that. What I suggest is that as these claims are considered and evaluated, and I know this is something that the city has done in the past, it might be worth your while to provide certain cases that you think might be worth settling in that way for a legal analysis and a settlement analysis. And I know that's something that I do and other attorneys in the state also do, where we're able to evaluate it and tell you the indemnity portion of this would probably settle in this range, we think. And then if that is something that would be agreeable, then the next step is to say, okay, let's figure out what the medical might cost here and then see if we can get it done in that way.
Okay. Well, thank you. If no one else.
May I ask a question?
Oh.
So I'm thinking about this, I think, in very simple terms. I think it seems good to be able to plan and predict and have a set amount that's a final settlement, whether it's a lump sum amount or whether it's structured over time. And that all sounds good. Is there a downside to a structured medical settlement, even though it's full and final? For example, if a miracle cure happens next year, we're trapped paying the structured full and final settlement for the duration of the full and final settlement. Is that correct? Is there also a flip side where we have to monitor that risk as well as the benefits we get from having a known amount that we can plan for and get off our books?
Well, there's no question that there's a risk like that. And even if you have a structured settlement, regardless of the way you form your settlement, if a miracle cure comes the next day, then there's not much that you can do about it. And the money would still have to be paid typically. And I'll tell you, just as an aside, years ago, one of the first projects I worked on as a young lawyer was one where they made a settlement, a significant settlement with a worker. And the settlement went for approval to the courts. And then the worker went out and got himself in a shootout with a SWAT team and was killed, before the settlement was even paid. But we wound up having to pay that amount for the wife, even though it was for benefits that the worker would never receive because he had died. And so there's always the risk that something like that can happen. And so the settlement can go either way in those circumstances. It can, in hindsight, be a very good settlement or as that one was, a very bad settlement.
Does Medicare have a rational approval process for what likely future medical costs could be? And do they consider things like what if a cure is found 5 years from now? Is part of that, or how?
I've never seen anything that has caused me to believe that they look at the possibility that there may be a resolution that would result in no need for future medical care. The process that they look at is basically saying, as we know things now, here is the medical treatment that would be needed in the future, and we're going to pay a lump sum for that, or pay the structured settlement. And the one thing, advantage that you might have, if you do a structured settlement and you don't buy an annuity, and if the worker passes away early, then you would no longer have to pay, assuming you wrote it into the settlement, which you normally would, you would no longer have to pay the yearly medical. But if you just bought an annuity, I don't think that you'd be able to escape that. So there is that option, but I'm not sure that that in and of itself is a should be a motivator for entering into the settlement. I think the settlement is more, as you said, you know what you've paid, and you know you're not going to have to pay, or you know exactly what you're going to have to pay in the future, or that you're not going to have to pay anything else.
Okay. Thank you. So, Ali, then, is that the end of, unless does anyone else have any discussion about the structured and final settlement, the presentation portion? And then do we need to move on to the proposed revision? I realize we've already exceeded our time. I saw something in the chat about rescheduling the 2:30 meeting. We're just continuing our meeting now and moving on to 5B, the proposed revision to the code to address these structured settlements. Yes?
Yes, we are moving on. I
or
think
final
that,
settlements, not necessarily structured always, but final settlements, whether it's a lump sum or structured or a combination. Okay.
So, yes, I think we are moving on. I want to thank Ted for providing that detailed explanation. It kind of helps us. We are actually moving on to section, actually it's 5B, and that piece, Chairman Dahmer, is directly related to an oversight when we did the repeal and replacement of the declaration. And what we did when we did the repeal and replacement of the declaration, what you see on the screen, is we totally removed the city attorney from the approval process. The city attorney is my connection and collaboration and facilitator and the ultimate authority when it goes to mayor and council. He is the appointed authority from the mayor and council, and it really is the ultimate person that can enter into any settlement agreement. And so we've got to put that back into the declaration. And so what I've done here is I've added that back into the actual agreement so that it's there. So that is actually item 3. And it's there on the screen. And what it says is if a claim or lawsuit exceeds the stated authority levels of 20,000, and what that 20,000 is if it's a single, for example, property damage, and if it's combined 40, which that's for bodily injury and property damage, the administrator, which is myself, must counsel with the city attorney for approval. The settlement also requires mayor and council approval after advisement from the city attorney. That's the process that's been in place since the declaration was adopted in 2011 that we removed. And so I'm asking that that be put back in place. So that's that particular piece is something that basically is a formality. And what I would like to do is rather than vote, and this will be something that I'm going to ask Julie, if we can vote on both revisions at one time or if we have to take it piece by piece.
I think you can both. I'm sorry. Yeah. Ali, I think that you can take them both at once because you're amending the one section of the code. One is a corrective, basically. It's to return the city attorney's role, which never really went away, but it's right. To put it back in place. And the other one, excuse me, that you want to add is the new part. So I don't see the need to vote twice for really amending the same sections of the code. You have the ability, once the chair calls for a motion, he can call for a motion that either reinstates and let it go at that, or for all changes to the code section, then he gets his second, or he doesn't. The motion could fail for want of a second, or it could be amended after there's discussion. But I think really in this instance, because this is really an administrative correction for the removal of the city attorney, and I know that was an inadvertent action. I know that was not done intentionally. I don't see the value in having two separate motions and two separate votes.
Awesome. So, Chairman Dahmer, with your permission, if there aren't any other questions about this administrative correction, I'd like to go on to the next slide, which would actually add in the language that we just heard the presentation from Ted Miller on regarding structured and full and final settlements. And that's on the next slide.
I lost you a little bit in the middle, Allie, but if you're saying let's move on to the next slide and address the second issue so I can do one motion for both, I'm all in favor of that.
That's what I'm asking. Thank you. So the next slide on your screen basically deals with adding in language. That language that we would be adding in essentially, and I'll let everyone read it here on the screen, that language essentially says and gives us the authority to begin looking at full and final settlements, but it's specific to the Arizona revised statute that Ted alluded to that passed in 2018. And what that statute does is it protects the employee. In other words, the employer cannot enter into any particular agreement without the Industrial Commission agreeing to whatever that agreement is. And we've gone a little bit farther in stating that we will not put an agreement in place, which we can't by statute anyway, without it being approved by the Industrial Commission. And then, of course, nothing is finalized without it going to Mayor and Council. But we have not put a dollar limit on it. And the reason for that is we have just looked at, when we're looking at structured settlements or full and final settlements, we are looking at dollar thresholds well beyond five figures. We're looking at six figures and above, especially with the reserves that we're looking at, the types of injuries that we're looking at. And that's what this particular language does. And this would be a new section, so we would have to bump the other sections down. And this would add it as section 18.9, and it would move the other sections down.
So, Allie, just one question, that Industrial Commission approval, is it the Industrial Commission that would get Medicare to approve the medical portion of the settlement? Does that, or how does, am I, should I not be looking for that in here at all then?
No, you wouldn't be looking for that in there at all. What happens when you enter into settlements, it becomes the settling party that actually works to get the Medicare approval. So when we settle right now, Keith, whether it's a liability settlement or a workers' comp settlement, it becomes the settling party's responsibility to work with Medicare and meet those requirements.
And then
the Industrial Commission would look to see that we've gone through all of those steps before they would approve it.
Okay. Thank you.
And I have the attorneys here, and Ted will correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're correct.
So then, Allie and maybe Julie, I have another question before we move on. I'm not, of course, any trustees, I believe we can still have some discussion about this before we need a motion, but I would like, Allie, just a reminder for me and the trustees about what our official role here is and what kind of motion you're looking for. My understanding is that as trustees, we are charged with primarily the responsibility to ensure the financial health of the trust that's used to sort of make sure that you're capable of self-insuring, and that it's not really our job as trustees to be involved in how the city handles their risk management and settlement activities. So I'm hoping you can give us a little bit of language. I do also appreciate that you value our information and our thoughts about what you're doing and that you would like our support, but we're really not in the process of actually recommending or approving the Tucson Code. So when we do make this motion, you know, we're in agreement with this kind of motion is what's coming, not a we're recommending approval of this. Is that, or how can you help me with how that works actually again?
Yes, I will. So how it works with the latest repeal and replacement, you have given the latitude of the day-to-day operations to the administrator.
Yes.
The trustees are responsible primarily for the investment and the financial status of the fund.
Yes.
All of the day-to-day operations becomes that of the administrator and the finance director, working in concert with the finance director. So this becomes primarily an educational and informational piece for you. But as trustees, you are still responsible to ensure that I'm doing my job correctly.
Okay.
So this comes before you as a knowledge base, but you also need to be aware and in agreement that this is a change that should be put in place in the Declaration of Trust, which becomes part of Tucson Code.
All right. So when we make the motion, it will be the motion that we are in agreement with the changes that the city wants to make to its code, basically.
That is correct, to the proposed Tucson Code.
Okay. Not that we're making the change.
Correct. The change will be proposed by the city attorney to mayor and council for the Tucson Code.
Yes.
It's a recommendation.
All right. So then unless there's any information that any of the other trustees would like to have, it feels to me like we're at the point where we need a motion for the trustees to take some action. So I will entertain a motion that would indicate our support of the city in making these two changes to section 9.8 and 9.11 as presented in this meeting, that we are in agreement with the changes that the city intends to make and think they're a good idea.
May I just ask a question? I'm sorry.
Certainly, Ted.
This section that's before us right now mean that every settlement is approved by the mayor and city council, every workers' compensation of all types, or just full and final settlements?
It's every settlement right now, Ted, that is above our authority levels, whether it's workers' comp or liability.
Okay.
Has to be approved by mayor and council.
Okay. So that's the 20,000 that we were looking at earlier.
That is correct.
All right. I just wanted to be sure that threshold still apply
yes.
with this. Okay. That's, I'm sorry. Thank you.
So then barring any additional information items from the trustees, I would like to entertain a motion to indicate the trustees' approval of the intended changes to the Tucson Code Chapter 18, Sections 9.8 and 9.11.
Can I just say so moved, or do I need to repeat all of that?
You can say so moved, and then the chair will call for a second, and he'll repeat the motion.
Okay.
Nicole Lowry has moved that the trustees agree with the city's proposed changes to Tucson Code Chapter 18, Sections 9.8 and 9.11 as presented in this informational meeting. And now I would like a second for Nicole's motion.
Second.
Was that Ted?
Yes.
Ted has seconded the motion. And now I will entertain any discussion or debate on our motion.
Chairman Dahmer, point of clarification. It is changed to section 9.8 through 9.11.
Thank you very much. So we are currently debating the trustees' approval of the city's intended changes to Tucson Code Chapter 18, Sections 9.8 through 9.11. I am not hearing a lot of lively debate on that motion. If we are not intending to have a debate or further discuss, if we would love to move to a vote, I will wait a moment to see if anyone wants any information.
Julie, I think he would need a friendly amendment to the motion so that it covers all of those sections.
I'm sorry. Did he change the motion from the first one that Nicole, was it the numbering that was needing to be corrected?
I misspoke when I stated the motion before. Okay. It should have been section 9.8 and then 9.11.
Okay, so that's an amendment to the original motion. You just need a second now on that amendment, and then you can take it to a vote.
Second. Do I have a second on the amendment to the motion to include all sections 9.8 through 9.11?
Second.
Thank you, Ted. Ted seconded the amendment to the motion. And now I would like to call for a vote. Let's do it the same way. All in favor of the motion to agree with the city's recommended changes to Tucson Code Chapter 18, Sections 9.8 through 9.11. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed to the motion as stated? I'm hearing no opposition votes to the motion, so I'm going to call the tally as unanimous for all trustees in attendance, that the motion to agree with the city's proposed changes to Tucson Code Chapter 18, Sections 9.8 through 9.11 has passed unanimously.
Very good.
Cool. Thank you very much. Now let's move on from item 5 to item 6. Any new business? Allie, take it away, please.
Yes, we have some changes in staff. So Mark Martin, who's been with the city for 11 and a half years as a claims adjuster, retired. With his retirement, we also had another claims adjuster who accepted a position with another company. So we have two open claim positions. With that, we were able to successfully promote Joanna Velasquez, who was our management assistant, who's on the call today, to a claims adjuster position. She started, it's almost 3 weeks ago now, and so she will be leaving her role as the management assistant and board assistant for the trustees. Coming on board beginning March 27th will be Veronica Hoddle, so she will start serving in that capacity. So you will have a new board support assistant when you guys meet again or when the trustees meet again, and a new risk management administrator when you meet again as well. So that is new for the team. I'm not sure when that meeting will occur, so definitely keep an eye out for that. The other thing that I wanted to announce was that we did actually get approval from the Property Tax Commission on our tort for FY22. So that information will be forthcoming with your new risk management administrator. And we just received that approval last week. So I just wanted to give that information to everyone. The other thing is that we did get ICA authority for the calendar year 23 successful. I will say in the 9.5 years that I've been here at the city, that's the first time that the city received ICA authority without having it be removed from the consent agenda. So that was the first success in the 9.5 years that I've been here. So that was excellent news. That's all of the new business that I have for the trustees. I don't know if there's anything else out there, Chairman Dahmer, but that's it on the staff side.
I'm not seeing any hands raised to discuss any additional new business, so I'll move on from agenda item 6 to agenda item 7. I'm going to do a call to the audience. Are there any members of the audience that would like to speak at our public meeting? I am not seeing or hearing any members of the audience who would like to speak, so we're going to move on to item 8, adjournment. I have a question here. Am I allowed to simply adjourn the meeting as chair, or does that take a motion and a vote, or?
You can go ahead and adjourn at this point. Sometimes it would take a motion, but I would say given that you've completed all business, there's nothing pending, you can adjourn the meeting.
It was fantastic spending the afternoon with everyone again, and I'm loving all of my new formal things to do, and I will study, and thank you, Julie, for the handout when I get it in the email, and we'll have a great next meeting. Allie, it has been an honor and a pleasure working with you. I remember first meeting you when I was still with the county and being pulled in to work on your risk board, and I was impressed. It has been a joy. And I have loved working with you. Congratulations on your new life ahead, and I wish you all of the best.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure. I have enjoyed every single moment of it, and you guys are going to be in excellent hands. It's an awesome team working here at the City and Risk. So enjoy and keep up the good work. You guys do good work for the city. I know it's a volunteer role, but I can't thank you guys enough for what you're doing to keep moving the city ahead. I appreciate everything that you do. And I'll run into you on the street somewhere, I'm sure.
So we'll have to look at our schedule of when people's terms end. And I see some good things, potentially.
Yes, I handed that out at the November meeting. So definitely. Take a look at that. I think Nicole's term is the one that's coming up, so she's eligible for another term if she likes.
I imagine there's someone named Allie who would make a good trustee in the future also.
Oh, no.
Which is where I was going.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we'll give you a year off, and then we'll see. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Happy trails, Allie.
Nice meeting.
Thanks.
All right.
Take care. All right.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.